While Western Europe was languishing in the so-called Dark Ages, there arose a new religion in what is now Saudi Arabia that would spread faster than any religion before it and bring a whole new way of thinking about food, a whole new culinary style to a huge expanse of land that would eventually stretch from Spain to India and even beyond to Southeast Asia. Of course, I'm talking about Islam. You would never guess that the culture of Islam would become so dazzling given its humble origins. It arose among nomadic peoples, Bedouin, in the deserts of Arabia. And we're talking about real desert here, endless drifts of sand with practically no water or vegetation, intense heat, completely different than any of the agricultural, fertile regions that we've been talking about so far. There's also no state here per se, only tribal leaders or sheikhs. And these people had such a rugged way of life that they really didn't have private property per se. The herds that they migrated with were owned communally by the tribe. And of course, because there's so little pasture, they have to continually move from oasis to oasis, where there's usually a small town that they could trade with or sometimes steal from. And this was, in fact, a warrior society. You know, power and prestige depends on how much you can steal from passing caravans. Between these vast deserts, there were, however, a few cities on the periphery, and they usually existed only because there was water, and many grew into sizable settlements, often containing a holy shrine, and also, incidentally, a good place to do trade, since they served as sanctuaries where rival tribes weren't allowed to fight. And it's in one of these, Mecca, that Islam arose. The Prophet, as he was called, Muhammad, and we actually know a great deal about his life, unlike most founders of religions. He was a merchant who married a wealthy widow and acted as a kind of business advisor for her. But it seems he didn't like his job too much because he was often found wandering off into the hills, where he began to have these visions and began to realize that he was the messenger of God and that there is only one God. Now realize this society at the time was pagan and polytheistic. But there were, in fact, Jewish and Christian populations in Mecca, and his ideas, we'll see, were very deeply influenced by theirs. In fact, Islam considers these earlier prophecies of the same God as Allah. And Islam is really just the last and most complete of these. And most importantly, of course, Islam is monotheistic. The word Muslim means a true believer, and Islam means submission to the will of God. Muhammad started to get followers, a lot of them in Mecca. And he was even invited to Medina to settle an internal dispute there. And this journey was called the Hijra, and it's where the Islamic calendar starts. It's 622 in the Western calendar, but year one for Islam. And in fact, everything he said from this point on was written down. It becomes the Quran. Now, without lingering on these details, Islam spread and spread like wildfire throughout the peninsula. And the armies of Islam converted the peoples it conquered through force. And this was not a religion of peace. But many people actually willingly joined. And I think it has something to do with the fact that Islam has an explicit vision of the pleasures that await the faithful in paradise. Judaism doesn't really have that at all, and Christianity only vaguely so. But for the Muslim, paradise is laden with fragrant flowers, running streams, cushions to rest on while you munch on exotic fruits and sweets. And in fact, every single sense is stimulated. There are even young virgins, the houris, to enjoy. In other words, heaven is a sensual, exotic paradise. And for centuries, Muslims would try to imitate this vision of paradise on earth by building pleasure gardens with fountains and eating elaborately prepared foods, by burning exotic incense and wearing perfumed silk. So unlike many other religions, there really is no stigma against sensual pleasure. Since it's what heaven is all about, why not enjoy here on earth what we can? So there's really also no ascetic tradition in Islam, with the exception of a few mystical sects that we'll talk about down the road. But for the most part, this is a religion that encourages the arts, with the exception of depictions of God, which is considered idolatry. But otherwise, architecture, music, and especially this really complex cooking, which they raise certainly to a fine art. And while Charlemagne is there munching on his big haunch of meat, Muslim civilization is creating some of the most exquisite dishes imaginable. But Islam does, in fact, have some food prohibitions, and they're like the Jewish ones in certain respects, but less complicated. And I think that's true of Islamic law in general. The Quran is really straightforward and practical and quite easy to understand. It borrows from Judaism and Christianity, but it's not as complex or filled with strange paradoxes and contradictions. And obviously that's the advantage of having been spoken by one person as the mouthpiece of Allah rather than many contributors. Well, in detail, pork is forbidden, as in Judaism, but no other meats except birds of prey and carnivorous animals also. Food sacrificed to pagan idols is also forbidden, as it is in Christianity. There's also the blood taboo. Animals have to be ritually slaughtered and painlessly, and a prayer is said over them, basically thanking the animal for giving its life to sustain humans. And along with the words, "In the name of Allah, Allah is great," while the animal's head is facing Mecca. And it's something I rather like in a way, especially if you think of our way of dispatching animals, you know, a stun gun or a blow to the head or something like that. This is a lot more humane, at least. And halal is the term for meat properly prepared and from which the blood is completely drained. And haram is the name for prohibited foods. Now, what is unique, however, is the prohibition against alcohol. And this is kind of hard to explain. Presumably, it's hard to focus on prayer when you're tipsy, I guess. But it stems from an incident in which a banqueter gets himself drunk and then starts getting violent after he's insulted somehow. And Muhammad is there, and he witnesses this, and he thinks it's probably best just to forbid alcohol. As you probably know, not all Muslim countries strictly observe this, though. In some regions, they still grow grapes for wine. And in fact, there's no strict enforcement by destroying vineyards. And as we'll see in authors like Omar Khayyam in Muslim Persia, they still drink great quantities of wine. But devout Muslims are supposed to abstain. And of course, many sects still do. And this prohibition, I think, is partly why coffee becomes so important. It originally comes from what is now Ethiopia. There's this story of this young goat herd boy named Kaldi who's noticing his goats sort of frolicking around after munching on the red berries of a certain tree. In any case, it becomes the ideal drink for the imam, the holy man, because it helps him stay up and pray and, of course, think and keep sober thoughts. And so coffee spreads very quickly throughout the Islamic world, and it's probably, to start with, a very different drink than today, because they didn't roast the beans. They're usually just infused green, as they, in fact, still do in Yemen. But now they're, roasted until they're dark. That's an invention of the Turks, and they, of course, drink it very, very thick. The interesting thing about coffee, though, is it doesn't get to Europe until the 16th, 17th century. So that's 1,000 years after they start drinking it in Arabia. There are also fasts in Islam. They're a bit more rigorous than in Judaism, and they're not just periods of abstention from meat, as we saw in Christianity. The devout Muslim abstains from all food and drink during daylight hours during the entire month of Ramadan, the ninth month. And that can actually fall at any time of year, because it's a lunar calendar. It's different than the solar calendar. Now, I have been told in many places, interestingly, that during Ramadan, they prepare very elaborate meals. So you can actually gain weight, during that month. But it's nonetheless considered a hardship because you're fasting all during the day. You're not even supposed to chew gum or drink water. Muslim customs, rather than law really, also dictate that people eat while sitting on the floor for the evening meal during Ramadan with a tray in front of you that contains all the food, from which you eat using 3 fingers of the right hand that have been washed. The left hand is used for other things, so it's considered polluted. So there are no utensils apart from, a spoon to drink soups and things like that. And in most of the Islamic world, food would be accompanied by a flatbread, which is used to scoop up or grab food. So it's really not unrefined at all. I mean, you might think, considering they're using their hands, but it's not. In fact, there's a kind of immediate tactile sensuality and connection to the food while eating with your hands. You know, it's very different when you eat with a cold metal utensil. You're kind of distanced from the food. You don't have that immediate sensory impact of it. There's also, in the Islamic world, something that seems to be an inheritance of the Berber custom of sharing food with any stranger who appears at your door. It's kind of a necessity in the desert, if you think about it, but it translates into this practice of effusive hospitality. In fact, I once read this story, really fascinating, of a man who is traveling in modern times through northern Africa. And he's invited into this family's home to enjoy a meal with them. And as an act of generosity, they open up the cupboards and there's all this bread that they have been storing, basically their year's supply. And they systematically break open every single one, which meant that it has to be eaten, right? Showing that they are offering absolutely everything they have in the house. Not holding back on anything. And it's also, interestingly, there's this implication of equality, because remember, everyone's seated around a low table with round plates of appetizers, maybe mezza on them. You know, it's sort of like tapas in Spain, but they're being shared communally, and there's no one really at the head of the table delving food out to other people. It's a statement of inequality, of equality, I think. Now, among most Muslims, they can eat with whomever they like, or sometimes only with people of the book. But there are some sects who only eat with other Muslims and would only be served food that's prepared by other Muslims. Some foods also, interestingly, take on this kind of semi-sacred status. I think above all else, it's dates, probably because that's sort of a staple of the diet in most of Arabia. But it makes its way into all sorts of rituals and festivities. Celebrating the date harvest, for example, is a really big deal. There's also attention paid to mutton. I would say that's probably the most important meat. And interestingly, the fat from the mutton tail is considered a delicacy. In fact, there are illustrations of the tail being carried behind the sheep on a big cart. It's amazing. And so is camel's hump. You know, that's... And camel's milk is one of those things that is sort of treasured among diners. Now, what is interesting, though, is that long after Muslims had spread out of the Arabian Peninsula, these remain elite foods, you know, associated with Arabia and with the Prophet, and they're actively sought out by the aristocracy, or at least people who wanted to eat like them. And it's sort of like people in this country, if they wanted to eat a delicacy from their ancestral homeland, even though their actual ancestors might not have been able to afford these products. Let me give you an example. Maybe the associations we have with caviar and champagne as sort of very special celebratory foods that make us think of the old country or Europe, you know? And so we keep them for special occasions. Another important point, as Islam expanded, it took over regions that were either part of the Byzantine Empire, who were, of course, the direct heirs to Greco-Roman civilization, so that these Muslims adopted their science, their medicine, their technology, their literature, and most importantly, they translated this material into Arabic and became an extraordinarily learned civilization. Furthermore, they added to Greek science in particular. For example, they adopt the Hindu-Arabic numeral system. They invent, and think of the al particle before all these words, they invent algebra. They expand upon astronomy, extremely advanced in optics, even in chemistry. And the original word, of course, is alchemy, right? Alchemia. And they invent distilled alcohol as well, which is kind of ironic given the prohibition, right? But again, they're reading Aristotle very closely for the first time centuries before anyone else in Europe is doing it. So for the first time, there is a real expansion in Greek idea, even more than with the Romans and the Byzantines. And one example in medical dietary literature, there's really only one major contribution made in Latin, I should say, Celsus. But in Arabic, there's, you know, I'd say the second most important writer after Galen. His name is Ibn Sina, or as he's called in the West, Avicenna. There's also Averroes, Johannitius, who was actually Christian, Maimonides, who is a Jewish author, and Isaac Israeli also. And note that Muslims not only tolerated and got on very well with Jews and Christians that lived in their realms, but there is, in fact, this very fruitful interchange of ideas, you know, especially in medicine and philosophy and literature. And I think, you know, it's hard for us to appreciate that from our vantage point in this time, but there, you know, the sort of intense animosity between Jews and Muslims is really very, very recent. The other civilization they rolled over is the Persians. And at this point, they were ruled by the Sassanid dynasty, who had actually been fighting with the Byzantines for decades and decades. And by this point, they're pretty much exhausted, which is partly why Islam spread so easily into these regions. In fact, people wanted to get rid of both of these big, nasty, you know, heavily taxing empires. But in any event, Islam also absorbed Persian culture, which had its own long, rich culinary traditions. And of course, it absorbed their wealth and the trade links that we'll see extend all the way into Asia. And this is the period when tales from the 1001 Nights become popular. Think of Aladdin and Genie and the flying carpets and, you know, eunuchs guarding the royal harems. That's the period we're talking about now. Perhaps more importantly, the first caliphate, or the rulers of Islam, made their capital in Syria, and this is called the Umayyad dynasty. But the one that happens in Persia, the second major dynasty, are the Abbasids, and they're the ones who founded their court in Baghdad around the year 750. Let me also mention that there's a certain tension within Islam between, on the one hand, those who would place society under a more secular rule and elect leaders from Muhammad's tribe, the Quraysh tribe. These are the Sunni. And on the other hand, there are those who would place religious leaders in control. And they descended from Ali, that's his son-in-law, or from his daughter Fatima. And these are generally Shiites. Okay, and the important difference between the more secular Sunni and the more fundamentalist Shiite. And of course, that's a distinction still made to this day. But there are, on the other hand, many, many other sects as well. So it's not just two varieties. Okay? One of these other sects I want to mention are called the Sufis. And these are mystics who believe that you could have this close, intense union with God right now, rather than waiting for the hereafter. And in fact, there's a great deal of debate over whether Omar Khayyam was a Sufi or not, and whether his great poem, the Rubaiyat, which is really mostly about getting drunk, you know, is perhaps a great metaphor for a kind of intense, ecstatic love of God, or whether it's just a poem about sensual pleasure. I think it must have been, at some level, a religious allegory, but that's really not why I like it so much. You know, a lot of disagreement, I think, really comes from the various translations. The 19th century translation made by Edward Fitzgerald assumed that it was really nothing more than this erotic, sensual, Eastern poem about pleasure. And that's, of course, why it became so popular in Europe. But there are newer translations that I think are much more close to the original intentions. But in any case, I encourage you to read it because it is a marvelous poem about drinking. But let's get to the cuisine. The dominant style of cooking in the Islamic world is also that of the Abbasid Caliphate in Baghdad. And we don't really know that much about the earlier Sassanid cuisine, but there's extensive documents from Islamic times. So it's hard to say, you know, how much of this stuff is inherited from earlier. But in any case, a distinctive, let's just say, Persian cuisine of this period favors young meats, things like lamb, kid, and veal, much more than mature ones. And these are usually roasted or fried in butter or oil. They're cut up into small pieces, so of course you can scoop them up. And they were considered the healthiest of meats by the Arabic physicians, and also the most delicate by the Persian nobles. And if you just think about how much these are valued even today, even in places like Spain, Cordero and Cabrito, and all the way across to northern India, it's not just a geographical thing. I think it has a lot to do with Islam bringing these Persian cooking techniques and preferences to all these other places. Meat was also often cooked with sugar or some kind of syrup. And that's something we haven't really seen elsewhere before, right? The Romans cooked with fruit, with meats, but now we're talking about sort of uncut direct sweetness. And incidentally, sugar becomes much more available now. It's increasingly cultivated after being introduced from India. And if you remember, the Romans, they sort of used it as a medicine, but the idea of marinating meats in sour sauces with a lot of spices, that's also really prominent in Persian cuisine. Think of things like shish kebab. I mean, that's really a Turkish word, but that idea of little packages of food, and chicken is also probably the most frequently eaten kind of fowl. Think of all the foods that were introduced by Islam into Spain. And in fact, the words in Spanish often come from Arabic, and then other European languages often get them from there. The most familiar one will be rice. You know, that's cultivated in Spain for the first time, but that word comes from Arabic into the other languages. Another example is spinach. It's isbanak in Arabic, espinaca in Spanish, and that's something that's really unknown in classical times. And the word eggplant. In England, they call it an aubergine, right? Well, the word berejena is derived directly from Arabic, badinjan, as it is in Turkish, banyas, in Hindi, brinjal. So an eggplant really travels, it begins in India, but it travels all the way westward, and makes its way to Spain and throughout Islam. Another vegetable, listen to the word, karshaf, al-karshuf, al-karchofa, karchofi, artichokes, right? It has nothing to do with the word choking. It's an Arabic word. But those are introduced, or let's say reintroduced by Muslims also, which is probably why our words from it descend from Arabic. There are also a whole slew of fruit trees, apricots, peaches, grapes that are often dried into raisins. All of those are used in cooking also. And there's this extensive use of crushed nuts in cooking, especially almonds and pine nuts and things that make dishes creamy. A handful of new fruits are introduced. Orange and lemons are introduced, especially to northern Africa and Spain, and spread bananas, at least to the more tropical Muslim regions. Something else the Persian cuisine excels at is sweets. And think of these syrupy fried globs, flaky thin pastries, things like kataif, crushed sesame candies like halva. And you'll find things like this all the way from India to Spain. Things like gulab jamuns, churros, those ancestors come from this cuisine. They also invented marzipan, kind of almond paste and sugar that can be molded into little shapes, and a sweet based on cooked down grape syrup and starch that's flavored with nuts and rose water. You might know the word lukum. It's a Turkish term called Turkish delight, but that's also from this cuisine. The Persians also invented iced fruit drinks. The word sherbet comes from there, as well as the ancestors of ice cream. And this is long before anyone else has figured out a way to lower the temperature of ice. They used to get it from mountaintops and store it in basements or ice houses, but then they would put saltpeter around it, sodium nitrate, and they'd put a canister or a bucket inside of that, and then stir it around, and then it freezes, and it becomes smooth. So they're real inventors of ice cream technology as well. Now realize that this is foremost the cooking of elite people, right? I mean, among poor people, there's a great deal of diversity from place to place, and there are common foods that didn't really travel. I mean, like couscous in northern Africa. It makes its way to southern Italy, but not much further than that. Fava beans, the ful madamas in Egypt. Chickpeas you find pretty much everywhere. They're ground into a paste. So, of course, you'll all know hummus. Or maybe they're fried, like falafel or tamia, which is the other version. And dairy products are also common everywhere. You know, it's mostly sheep or goat cheeses, yogurt. But poorer people tended to eat much darker and coarser breads made from grains other than wheat, just as in Europe. And there was a medical rationalization to this as well. The idea was that poorer people who get a lot of exercise have a much stronger digestive system, and therefore they can digest coarser foods, while the sedentary need lighter, whiter foods. And you know where they got this idea from, right? It's Galen. And yes, they're translating and reading his works. And in fact, the medical system that flourishes across the whole Islamic world, just as it did in India, is Unani medicine. The Muslims also initiated what undoubtedly can be called an agricultural great leap forward, if not revolution. New irrigation practices. In fact, in the area of California where I live, this is called Hinduing because it was introduced by the Sikhs. New extensively cultivated fruits and vegetables, crop rotation systems. In fact, The plant that they introduce here is called alfalfa, right? Or as it's called in Europe, lucerne. But it's a fodder crop for off seasons rather than letting the ground lay fallow. So these practices, they wouldn't start using in Europe for another few hundred years, really. Using the theory I offered you earlier in the course, I would say that this cuisine benefits from an extensive court culture, a great deal of time, extensive trade networks that offer a variety of ingredients, definite and strong tradition of extended families, in this case, often with many wives, but certainly that's one way to transmit culinary knowledge from one generation to another. And also, if not restaurants in the modern sense of that word, there are coffee houses, which act as a place for men to socialize, drink together, and after the 16th century, smoke, of course, from a communal hookah. And coffee houses also do prepare simple foods and sweets. So I would say the prerequisites for the development of a complex culinary culture are definitely in place. I would say the strengths of this cuisine is also to a great extent due to the attention paid to the senses. I mean, far more attuned to aroma and the texture of food on the fingers and in the mouth. And even the presentation, I think greater so than anywhere we've seen before. An example, perfuming foods with substance like ambergris, which comes from whales, and musk from deer. And that, we'll see, catches on briefly later in Europe, but most Europeans would sort of quake at the idea, especially today, right? Or even camphor, seeing that in food, kind of the flavor of Vicks VapoRub, you know? Rose water is one of the most common ingredients in all kinds of dishes and has this beautiful, intense floral aroma. And then, of course, the spices are central. Cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, cloves, cardamom, all aromatic, mixed in all sorts of interesting ways, which is exactly where both Northern India and medieval Europe learn it from. At this point, the trade routes flourish, and they don't just extend into Europe anymore. But Arabic really becomes the universal language that facilitates that. Remember, the Quran has to be read in Arabic. Now, regarding the look of food, Muslims were fond of coloring dishes as well: yellow with saffron, red with sandalwood, green with mint. And that's another thing we'll see. Europe imitates. And the consistency of food is also very important. They can make it creamy with nuts, garnished with raisins or pistachios. So you get this combination of smoothness, sort of punctuated by crunchy bits. It is incidentally the exact sort of complexity you find in the music and in the architecture. Lots of similar motifs repeated in these geometric patterns, or standard melodic lines and rhythms repeated and overlapped from instrument to instrument. And what is interesting is that the food is also usually cooked slowly over a low fire, making it very tender. So there's rarely eating of rare meat or salted meats or things like that, but almost always fresh and then cooked until soft. And again, that's because it's easy to eat with flatbread and your fingers. But there's also this delight in crunchy things wrapped up in little parcels that are fried and can be picked up and eaten, like sambusak, or what they call samosas in Northern India, or little thigh-shaped balls of meat called kifteh. The medieval Muslims also had their bizarre condiments. Muri is one of those. It's kind of a salty, fermented, or some say rotted barley sauce made by crushing and soaking barley and then letting it age on the roof for several months. And actually, there are people who make this nowadays. And I think it's something like soy sauce. There's also extensive use of sumac, a nice sour red sort of berry, pomegranate seeds and other sour flavorings, things like vinegar, citrus juice in foods. So in the next lecture, we're going to see what Europeans are doing at the same time and the impact that encounters with the Islamic East have on them, and especially their cooking during the European High Middle Ages.